History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. Ask a few questions, take some time to listen, and don't be surprised if you end up amazed by what you end up hearing. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, and I know that's going to be the case today, but so often we also find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Some of the tales we end up hearing include intense moments in combat, whether land or sea or sky. We've also met plenty of veterans over the years who served in more behind-the-scenes roles. More than 16 million Americans were in uniform during World War II, but a good portion of those we've met on Hometown Heroes over the years have reminded us what a difference millions more made on the home front in a variety of ways, like those who made sure the troops overseas would have enough to eat and drink, those granted agricultural deferments to keep supply lines flowing. The centenarian we have the privilege of meeting today was one of those whose role in the ag sector was such that he didn't have to serve in the military. But before World War II was over, he decided to join the Army anyway. And you will hear in very candid fashion why he made that choice. He would end up participating in the final battle of the Pacific War at Okinawa, followed by occupation duty in Japan. But California's Kings County, and specifically the city of Lemoore, is where we find 100-year-old Frank Barberia. Let's go back as far as you can. I know 100 years is a long time to go back, but tell me where you were born and what you remember about your earliest years, Frank.
I was born in late in 1924, and I still remember before I went to first grade. I was in the fifth grade. I still remember everything from the time I was 5 years old on up. I remember everything that just went on.
Well, this will be pretty fascinating then, because people today really haven't heard too much about the 1920s and 30s and the Great Depression. But let's talk about your family a little bit. You're the oldest of five kids. Tell me where your parents came to America from.
From Terceda Island. That's that picture, big picture out there. That's the island they came from.
In the Azores, a long way from California. Did they tell you much about the old country?
Well, about 35 years ago, me and my buddy, we flew over there, and I went to visit Mike. I still had uncle and an aunt there and cousins, but now they're just about all gone now.
And as a child, as the oldest of those five kids, I'm guessing you had the toughest chores at home.
My sister was the oldest one. I was second.
The oldest of the three boys.
Yeah.
So how old were you when you milked your first cow?
Me? Oh, probably 12 years old, something like that. Ball by hand. And then when my first steady job, I was 15 years old. For my neighbor just down the road from where we live, I got $15 a month and work all day in the field with horses. Oh. $15 now, I need to get $20 to make hamburgers an hour.
Times have definitely changed, Frank. And, you know, most people alive today did not live through the Great Depression. Can you give us some examples of what life was like back then that's a little different from the way things are now?
Well, everybody was happy in them days. Everybody helped one another. Oh, you know, all your friends, you had work to do. Haul hay in at that time was with horses and hay wagon. You take your team of horses, go help the neighbor, and the neighbor comes help you. Everybody helped one another in them days. Everybody was friendly. Now it's altogether different. You don't even know your next door neighbor.
Well, and I think I hear some echoes of what some other veterans have shared with me who lived through that era, you know, because we think of it now as we see these images of soup lines and the Dust Bowl and unemployment and all this. We think of what you didn't have. I've had a lot of veterans say, well, we didn't know what we were missing. This is just the way things were. Did you kind of feel that way, even though there wasn't a lot, you were content with what you had?
You know, when I always think I was 20 or 19 or 20 years old, I was working at this dairy. They get you a deferment, 6-month deferment for working. And if you quit, they have to report you to the draft board. Mm-hmm. And I was getting up at 3 in the morning. I only weighed about 120 pounds. I was all this. And milk cows. And then when I got through milk, and we'd go have breakfast, and then I'd have to go out and feed the cows, pitch green hay on top of a hay wagon to feed the cows. And I said to myself one day, if I stay here, I'm going to die. So, and if I go to the Army, I got a 50-50 chance. So that's what I did. I quit. When I did, they reported me to draft board, and they put me on 1A and drafted me.
Well, I want to come back to that. I want to hear a little more about your childhood, though, too, because I think it'd be interesting for kids today to hear about this. So you're one of 5 kids, 3 boys and 2 girls. Your parents are Portuguese immigrants from the Azores. What'd you guys do for fun? What did kids do back in those days to stay busy or keep your minds occupied?
Well, I don't know. As kids, we'd just go with the neighbors. We all had kids our age. Go with them and play with them, this and that. And we did a lot of swimming because our ranch down the road there's a big canal used to go right through it. We used to do a lot of swimming in there. That's about, we had a lot of fun as kids, you know. We raised a lot of hell in our time. Go out and steal watermelons. I don't know if you ever got into that or not, but...
Well, hopefully the statute of limitations is up on that by now. You know, and in this part of California, a lot of these small rural towns have their Portuguese halls, the DES. How big a deal was that Portuguese immigrant community? How big of a presence in your life was that?
Oh, yeah. We used to hang around that, yeah. Where they have these Portuguese celebrations you're talking about, yeah.
The festas.
Yeah, festas, yeah. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, I got a pot of sopas in there from the Visalia celebration.
And some people don't know what sopas is, but if they've ever been to a festa, they certainly know. So did you guys speak Portuguese in the home?
Yeah. My mama could speak Portuguese, never could speak English too good. My dad did. I think when he was 12 years old, when he came over, that he went to grammar school for a year or two here. He spoke good English, but mostly they spoke to us in Portuguese.
And when you were going to grammar school, when you were that little guy, do you remember having any hopes and dreams of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I want to do with my life?
No, I guess just working the ranch like we, as kids, of course, when we was in our 12, 10, 12, 13 years old, even younger. Used to be a lot of fruit around here. My mom used to work, cut fruit in a lot of these different places, and as kids go over there and pick fruit. We worked on fruit a lot, cut grapes to make a living back in the 30s.
And you're really close now to a Navy base, Naval Air Station Lemoore. I'm sure you hear those Super Hornets flying over. I bet you remember when they were building that.
I remember before they built that, as kids were probably 16, 17 years old, and we had Model Ts, and we'd go out there. That was sagebrush out there, and we'd run chase jackrabbits with our Model Ts. Yeah. Matter of fact, my Model T didn't have no tires. It was just rims. Mm-hmm. And we'd take off down the Kings River all the way down to, out there to the west side, and chase jackrabbits with their Model Ts. We'd take 2 Model Ts.
So they always heard you coming then, huh?
Oh, we had a lot of fun, yeah. We enjoyed it a lot better. I think we enjoy it better. We worked hard, a lot harder than these kids work now, you know. But we had fun. We enjoyed it. Now it's altogether different living. It's, I don't know. I still like them old days better, even though you worked a lot, pretty hard, you know, because we knew everybody. Everybody helped one another and everything, you know.
And I was mentioning NAS Lemoore, of course, when it was built in the World War II era, it was an Army airfield. So that what has now become the Air Force was using that runway out there after you wore it in with the rims on your Model T. And you told me that you decided to quit school at age 16?
Yeah.
What was that all about?
Because what happened, I was milking cows at this dairy, and then I was going to high school then, and I'd sleep, you know, go to sleep, and my teacher, my first class was history. Mrs. Wooten was her name, and she told me, said, I know you get up early, Frank, so that's why I don't bother you, I'll let you sleep. So one day, one of the girls from the office came up there to my class there and said, told Mrs. Wooten, they want Frank down there in the office. So I went down there and had a long table there with men sitting on both sides, you know. And they started asking me questions. I think there's something to do with probation guys from the... And they asked me how come I sleep in school, this and that. And I told them I get up at 3 to milk cows and this and that. For who? I told them who it was for. And so they notified my, she was a widow woman. And they had me quit my job. And then when I made 16, I rode my bike from 16th, well, this is 16th Avenue, but we lived on the other, about 4 miles down the road. I rode my bike all the way to school, checked in, and went back to milking cows for $20 a month then.
And you already mentioned, you know, initially you had agricultural deferments and then you decided the Army was better. I want to ask you about something before we get into that, because everybody who was alive then seems to have some kind of memory. December 7th, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were and how you found out?
I was, I think I was milking cows in L.A. I was 17, I think. And then they had something like all of a sudden, we was milking cows there. It was in town of Artesia, and all of a sudden we hear these guns go off. We didn't even know there was anti-aircraft guns around us. They said Japanese planes that went over L.A., but it wasn't. I think they were just trying to scare the people, but everybody got scared.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I couldn't remember that.
Yeah, they call that the Battle of Los Angeles. So you're saying you actually heard anti-aircraft guns going off in L.A.?
Oh, yeah, I heard a lot. All over, man. I didn't know there was so damn many around there.
And when you heard, you know, that Japan had attacked America, how big a deal was that? Could you understand what that meant?
Wasn't much we could do about it. Some of the guys, they were scared, but it wasn't it couldn't have been Japanese planes. We seen all them searchlights going, man, I didn't know there were so many around there. Lit up that sky.
Yeah, there was a real fear that if they hit Hawaii, they might be hitting California. Thankfully, that didn't happen. I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. And another thing that comes to mind, growing up here in Kings County, had you had any friends or classmates who were Japanese American?
Yeah, we had two families that lived over there by us. They were nice, real nice people. I got a good friend of mine. He married to, they called me Uncle Frank, but he was born up there to where they had that Japanese camp up north, Thule.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was born there. Nice guy. We still contact one another. But you can't beat them. Japanese people are real nice. They're not like us. You know, they're strictly workers. They don't mess around, go to drinking at bars or racing cars or stuff. They work, you know. I never knew the people were so nice till when I went into Japan. When our plane went over Japan to get ready to leave, and I looked down there and I seen all them Japanese people there. They all had bikes. They didn't have cars in them days. Man, I was kind of worried, you know, because here you are in Japan, you don't know what the hell's going to happen. And they were the nicest people you could. They'd walk by you and bow to you and everything. They were real nice. It was just their leaders is what, well, just like Hitler, Mussolini. They were guys that, or like guy in Russia now that's causing all this trouble, you know. They don't care about killing people. One thing I hated to see is when they dropped that bomb, the atomic bomb, you know. So they, you know, you killed a lot of honest people. I guess it saved us a lot of lives. Kept us from invading Japan. It saved a lot of lives.
And Frank Barbera's life could very well be one of them. It's time for our first break, but a reminder that you can find photos of Frank and more information about some of the things he's sharing at hometownheroesradio.com. Some of you may never have heard of that Battle of Los Angeles and what happened in Southern California in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor. It's a pretty fascinating, if brief, chapter of World War II history. And I do have a link to more information for you there online. We're going to hear more of 100-year-old Frank Barbera's World War II memories when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 100-year-old Frank Barbera of Lemoore, California, a native of Layton, California, just a little ways north of there, the oldest boy among five children born to Portuguese immigrants from the Azores. Frank served in the 27th Infantry Division during World War II, including the Battle of Okinawa. I want to make sure that I heard you right. So you said, you know, the war's going along, you've got these agricultural deferments, but you got so tired of tossing hay and working with cows that you thought you'd rather go get shot at than stay on the farm?
I figured I was had a 50-50 chance.
Did you start rethinking that when you got to boot camp?
It didn't bother me at all.
Yeah.
Even when I got off the ship, you know, and they put us there in Okinawa, it didn't bother me at all. You know, the only thing it kind of got a little bit scared is when that plane flew over and over Japan and I seen all them people. Here we are. Something happened. But they were so nice.
Walk me through it. So you give up your deferment. You could have stayed here and never gone to the war.
Right. I could have.
But you decide to go. So
Where did you go to boot camp, and what'd they make you do?
Where I went to camp?
Yeah.
Camp Roberts here, just where I took my infantry training. And then 12 weeks later, then they shipped us up, well, by railroad up to Vancouver Barracks in Washington, which is right across Oregon there. The Columbia River splits Vancouver Barracks. There's a little POE there, Port of Embarkation. We was there 2 days. I didn't know where in the hell we was going. They never did tell us. All of a sudden, they put us on the trucks. I didn't know where we was going. They didn't go too far. Here's this troop ship right on the Columbia River. And we come down the Columbia River. That was, it's kind of pretty going out there. But when we got out there to the mouth of the, it was rougher than hell out there. Some guys got sick. And then we went all the way from there. It was a small, it wasn't too big of a ship. One of them ships that they used to build overnight.
A Liberty ship?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. From there, we went straight to Hawaii. I think it took us 5 days. We was all alone, no escorts or nothing, you know. Of course, they figured the Japs wasn't around there anymore, their subs. They used to be around there. Then in, when we got to Hawaii, fueled up there at Pearl Harbor, and then we picked up three troop ships, big ones, and our escorts, destroyers, submarine destroyers. Then we went in. I think our next stop was the Marshall Islands, the Kwajalein's or whatever. That was the last battle that they had there before they went into Okinawa. We was there one day, picked up some more ships, and then from there we went straight to Okinawa.
I know it's a long time ago.
32 days on the boat.
Had you ever been on a ship before that?
No.
Did you get seasick at all?
No. I do when I go out fishing, though.
Well, I want to ask you about that later. So here you are, you know, you volunteered to give up your exception and go serve. I guess I should ask you how your family felt about that. Was your mother concerned about you?
Oh, yeah. They all do. That was the first time I seen my dad cry. But it didn't bother me. I wasn't afraid to go.
Well, that was my next question. Did you really know what you were getting into, and did you contemplate whether or not you'd be coming home?
Yeah, you got that in mind. You don't know what's going to happen, you know. Something could have happened to you out, submarine hit you or something, you know. You don't know. No, I really wasn't that scared going over there. If I was, I wouldn't have gave up the job working on the ranch. Because they could have got me more deferments, you know, and kept me out. But I couldn't take it anymore.
So 32 days on the ship, and then you come into Kwajalein where they've been fighting. At any point, are you seeing things that tell you, you know, this might get a little risky for me?
Well, yeah, they're the Marshall Islands. Things looked pretty rough. They had a rough battle there, but when we got to Okinawa, they announced that they had to get us off the ship quick because the day before, the Japanese sunk a ship there, but that was bull.
Just wanted you guys to hurry, huh?
Yeah, I don't believe that. And then at night, the island we went on had one of the biggest air bases there in Okinawa. It was the Kadena Airport. That was a big base there. At night, they had the sirens blowing like they had an air raid, you know. And where we got off was a lot of foxholes there because they had a beachhead there before. And everybody looking for a hole to get into, but I think that was bull crap. I think it was more or less to scare us or something. It didn't bother me. What are you going to do?
So they stick you in the 27th Infantry Division?
Yeah. That division, from what I read, I had a book on Okinawa. That division came from Philippines when the war entered in the Philippines, came over there to help out because they were having problems. And when I joined that, they they were pretty well short on men. So they were trying to, you know, build up all their deals before the invasion of Japan, which never happened, which I'm glad of.
They put you in a rifle platoon or what?
Yeah. We did go out, look for stranglers, but we never did find any. A lot of them, they headed up to the hills after the war hide, you know. But we didn't chase them up there. There was women there, American women, the way they call wax. I've seen some of those. We'd be out there where our camp was right next to the ocean. We'd be out there swimming naked. And them girls would drive by in their jeeps and
wave to you?
Oh, yeah, they'd wave at us. Well,
well, you make it sound like a big vacation or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It was all right. Everything worked out good for me. I happened to get on a D8 tractor. They put me on a D8 tractor, one of the big Caterpillars then at that time. They were finishing a base there at Atsugi. And then from there, they sent me. I was the first one to go to Tachikawa. Tachikawa is pretty well known. A lot of American planes land there now. We made a 7,000-air strip there, and then when we got through, we were supposed to go to Yokota and build a 10,000-foot strip there for B-29s, but then I had come home, then I didn't get to go with her.
Where were you when you found out that Japan had surrendered?
Okinawa, yeah.
What do you remember about how that news came to you and what it meant to you and the guys?
Well, it made us feel good, you know, but... Because we heard they dropped the bomb, you know. Mm-hmm. But they didn't quit at that first bomb. They wouldn't give up. They had to drop the second one, which was bad. Yeah, I don't know why they kept fighting. There wasn't nothing. They didn't have nothing. Tokyo and Yokohama was all destroyed. All there was left there was the Imperial Palace. And they were told not to bomb the Imperial Palace. And then right there next to it, some tall buildings where MacArthur had his GHQ, his building, his office and everything. But yeah, they didn't have nothing. I don't know why they kept fighting. They stripped every piece of iron they had off of everything. And I don't know why they didn't quit instead of killing people. Well, when after the war, you know, that Tojo's the one was... It didn't take long for them to hang him after the war.
Well, and there's even a story where he and some of that, you know, military regime wanted to stop the emperor from surrendering. They wanted to keep fighting even after that.
Yeah. And finally, the one that made him quit was the emperor, yeah. He's the one that finally said, that's enough, after they dropped the second... He said, that's enough. It shouldn't have happened. I hated to see all them poor people like that, you know.
Are there some, I mean, I don't want to be gruesome or salacious, but are there some things that you saw while you were on the island of Okinawa that kind of underscored the gravity of what happened there?
It didn't seem like there was too much I could to see there, you know. I didn't see no village or nothing because it wasn't the mainland. Naha was the capital of But we were on an island where that Kadena Inn and airport was, which was the big one there. Actually, I didn't really see nothing there for them to destroy, but just kill one another.
Did you guys have a pretty big party when you heard about the surrender?
Well, we didn't. No, we didn't. We just said, oh, boy, that's about it. Uh-huh. No beer, no whiskey.
And so they send you over to Japan for occupation. How'd you get from Okinawa to the mainland of Japan?
We flew.
Had you ever flown before?
No.
So that was something new.
Yeah, that's why I had to.
You didn't like it?
Well, it was smooth. I don't know, a couple hours probably. It was nice, two engine planes, 46 and 47. And then some of them B-17s, I heard that they hauled guys in them too because they wanted to get as many guys over there as they could. The cavalry division was there. The 1st Cavalry Division was there.
Well, what did they have you doing over there?
Working on the airstrips. And the last 6 months, probably, I was there. I got off of heavy equipment, and then they made me as a foreman of the heavy equipment on the airstrip.
So this was with the engineer company?
43rd Engineers.
Did you?
They wanted me to stay and re-enlist, but no way.
How long were you over there?
A year.
So you must have interacted to some extent with some of the Japanese people.
Yeah, especially the girls. A lot of them there.
Did you bring home any special souvenirs?
Yeah, I had brought home a long samurai sword, one a Japanese rifle. Japanese rifle I traded for a 30-30, and then my sword I gave it to my grandson, and he turns around and sells the things. The only thing is I got some old flags that was taken from guys there in Okinawa, you know, soldiers that got killed.
Those flags carried by Japanese soldiers have visible bullet holes and bloodstains, and one of them carries the signatures of well-wishers from that enemy soldier's hometown, which ultimately could lead to another chapter of this story. We'll see. If you'd like to see the flag in question, or see what this super sharp and ingratiatingly self-deprecating centenarian Frank Barberia looks like, check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll come right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch of an engaging and unpredictable conversation with 100-year-old Frank Barberia of Lemoore, California. He gave up an agricultural deferment to enlist in the Army, and made it to the Pacific in time for the Battle of Okinawa with the 27th Infantry Division, later building runways in Japan during occupation duty there with the 43rd Engineer Battalion.
So I asked you about souvenirs. The Japanese gun got traded, the samurai sword got sold, but you have three flags of varying sizes here, the Rising Sun flags. One of them has Japanese characters written all over it. How did you come to acquire these?
Like, I used to trade them for my beer or cigarettes to the fellows that happened to get these from me. You know, when they killed somebody, they got these flags off of them. That's how I got them. I didn't get it off anybody. The other guys got them, and like I say, I trade my beer or my cigarettes for it.
And it sounds like over the years, you've learned more and more about what the significance of these flags would be.
Yeah, I finally found out the other day what the... I'm going to donate it to this woman. I don't know what she's going to do, probably about 80 years.
Yeah, and I can see bloodstains on them. What do you think about when you look at that and you see the bloodstains and the bullet holes and the writing on those flags?
Don't think much of it anymore. The only thing that, you know, what bothers you sometimes, you know, if you had a son and he got killed over there, you know how you'd feel. And I know how they felt when they found out their son got killed, you know, be the same thing, you know. That's too bad. Too bad we had to go through all this crap, but should have never happened. If they weren't asleep in Hawaii, we probably wouldn't have had this. But they were asleep in Hawaii. They let them Japs come over and tear us apart.
And so you have a friend here who told you what the significance of those flags is.
Yeah.
And if they were able to decipher, and by reading the Japanese characters there, zero in on which particular soldier carried that flag, would you want his family to have it?
Oh, I don't care what she'd do with it, you know. It'd be nice for the if there was any of them or they could contact some of them. I don't know if she can or not. She might be able to.
And that makes me wonder, as I heard you, you know, put yourself in their shoes, if you had a son that was lost, it makes me wonder, did you have any friends, whether there were friends back here in the States or friends in the Army, did you have any friends who didn't get to come home?
Oh, yeah, some that I went to high school with. Then I had a couple of them that got killed in Korea. I don't know of any in Vietnam, though. But in Korea, I had a cousin. Then my brother got wounded twice in Korea. Oh, well.
So your cousin was killed in Korea, is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
What was his name?
Holman. His name was Mangel Holman. They lived down in L.A.
Did you ever find out what happened to him?
No, I just heard that he got killed there. Then a friend of mine, Miguel, got killed there, too. That was the only two that I knew of.
And what happened to your brother over there?
Well, he passed away already. He's about 4 years younger than me. No, he wasn't much for talking about that. All he said is, hell, he'd never seen no Chinese. Before you knew it, he was laying on the ground. I guess some shell or something, you know, because he had shrapnel over his legs and like that. Another war, I don't know what the hell they went over there for. That and Vietnam. This country likes to stick their nose in other people's business.
Did the time that you spent on Okinawa and in Japan, did that change your perspective on life at all?
No.
What'd you do when you came back home?
Well, when I came back home, I said I was going to take 2 weeks off and not work. The second day I was ready working for my... Had two different guys came over there to get me to go to work for them, in which I wouldn't work for 1 week. I only had 1 day off.
What kind of work did you do the rest of your life?
Most of my work was drive heavy equipment over here. I was a land leveler, you know. For my boss used to own all this property here. He had two TD-24s, and I used to run one of them for years for him. And then I went to Watsonville, worked for a drilling company there 12 years, and then I came back doing all the truck driving and backhoe work, but it's okay.
Well, and not too many people live to be 100, and if they do, most of them aren't as sharp as you, so I'm sure you've been asked about what your secrets are. You going to share any of your secrets with us?
My secret, I tell everybody the same thing. Even when I go to the VA, to my hospital over there, the nurses, the doctors, what's your secret? Everybody asks me. And I always tell them, good whiskey and wild women. They get a kick out of that. That's my secret.
Are you ever able to keep a straight face while you say it?
Yeah. Good whiskey and wild women. Matter of fact, I said that to one over there at the party the other day. This girl was sitting, she wanted to take a picture with me, and she asked me, what was my secret? And I told her. And I said, but you, good whiskey and wild men. She got a kick. She got a kick. That's my secret. That's what I tell them all.
Well, you're still here. You mentioned before, you know, you didn't get seasick on those 32 days heading from the West Coast out to the Pacific, but that you did go in deep sea fishing. So I got to meet you at an event put on by the A to Z Foundation. And one of the things they do for veterans is they take them on fishing trips.
Yeah.
Tell me about this trip you made with them.
I made two of them with them. Last year I went on two of them.
Where'd you go? What'd you do?
We went on Otamoro Bay. The second one, then they went north. quite a ways, which was a lot better. We caught some good fish down there, though. But I guess they got one in August coming.
You gonna go again?
Oh, yeah.
So, there's a picture here of you with a whole mess of fish.
Oh, yeah.
And I heard they didn't think you could reel all that in yourself?
Yeah, well, a friend of mine next to Luke's son-in-law was next to me. Once in a while, I'd give him the pole. But they bought an electric reel now for me to use.
But I heard you didn't want to use it last time. You insisted on reeling it all yourself from like 400 feet?
They didn't have any last year. Yeah, that was kind of a surprise, them having this deal for me. They gave me a nice trophy there.
Well, what did that mean to you that they would want to recognize your service to our country that way and give you a trip like that?
I don't know why. Hey, I'm not the only one went over there.
But you're one of the only ones left.
Not too many. I see some of them guys coming out from that flight over. They're all on wheelchairs.
Not you.
No. When I go to the hospital there, they ask me, what you in here for? I don't know. You guys sent me anything wrong? I said, no.
Well, and you mentioned the honor flight, so these have been happening in this area for over a decade, but you haven't gone yet. Why not?
Just the flying.
You're not a big fan of flying.
I just never was too crazy about flying. About 35 years ago, this friend of mine, he was in the Air Force. Matter of fact, he was tailed in on a bomber and it crashed there in Oklahoma. And he had to bail out. I think he was the only survivor. Anyway, their folks was my good friends, my folks, and they were. And his folks was from a different island than us. And he's always wanted me to go with him over there. I said, "No, I ain't gonna fly. I'll go on a boat." He said, "I'll be coming back, and you'll be still going over there." So finally, one year, about 35 years ago, I said, okay, I'll go if we drive from here back east instead of flying clear. He said, okay. So we drove from here to Massachusetts, which he has a cousin lives in. We left the house, left the car at his house, and then 4-hour flight then from there to Azores. That wasn't too bad then.
Was that sentimental for you to see where your parents had grown up?
Yeah, my mom's sister was still living in the little house. And her brother, John, he lived right up in the hill there, little house there. Actually, they live off of their gardens. See, there's no ranches like we got here. Some has maybe a garden on top of the roof of the house, you know, and they raise a pig. It's next door to the house there and everything. And like my mom's sister, her husband, he didn't know car at that time. They have donkeys. His donkey was right next to the house. That's where he kept. That's like his car, you know. Mm-hmm. But when I went over there, they were starting to have cars.
So if we can convince you to go on this honor flight, you'll go with 70 other veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam War. You'll see the World War II Memorial.
When we went back east that time ago, we stopped there at Washington. But, it was hotter than hell that day. It was in July. And we walked around there a little bit, seen Abe Lincoln sitting there and... But it's a lot different now. They didn't have that memorial deal or...
Yeah, the World War II and Korean War memorials weren't built yet back then. And now they are. So you would see, you know, 4,000 gold stars representing 400,000 Americans who didn't come home from World War II, and the Korean War memorial, and where your brother was wounded, where your cousin was killed. The names of 36,000 Americans are now etched there, and you could find your cousin's name, and you see these statues of soldiers walking through the rice paddies. And I'm sure it would bring to mind a lot of memories and emotions for you.
See some of my friends there, I don't know.
Well, I know that everyone would be honored to take you if you decide to do it. When you see that picture on the wall of that young kid in an Army uniform 80 years ago, does that make you proud?
To me, just a picture. But it was worth it going over there. You know, it wasn't, the heavy fighting was all gone. I was pretty lucky. just go over there and patrol a little bit around them hills. Yeah, I was pretty lucky.
You didn't run into any booby traps or anything in those patrols, did you?
No.
Well, let me ask you this. I've just got a few more questions, and if there's anything else that you want to add, feel free. I mean, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. When you think back over 100 years, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
The only thing I'm proud of, I got 3 nice kids. They're real nice kids.
Who wouldn't be here if you didn't come home from the war?
You know.
And the other thing that I'm curious about, when I meet someone who's reached a milestone age like this, 100 years, is whether there's anything you haven't done yet in 100 years that you're still hoping to do.
Not to fly. You know, when I've had chat last year, my nephew, I had a paid trip to go to Alaska for a week. They went fishing up there, and I didn't go. I've had several trips, you know, offered to me. My nephew's been real good to me. He really threw a party for me on my 100th.
Yeah, tell me about that. Were you surprised at all by everything that happened there?
Well, for a long time. We have one every year at this shop, but this was, he said, when you make 100, I'm going to have the tent out there, and which he did. He had a big tent, about 200 people, big tent, riding bowl, a bar out there. Oh, he went all the way. Now and I got another one, the Legion. I belong to the VFW and the Legion and the AMVETS in Tulare. Now the Legion's supposed to call me, I heard. They want to have something for me, too, now. Mm. Oh, it's hell to be 100.
Well, I got to ask you, did you get up on that riding bull at your 100th birthday party?
Yeah, my nephew put me up there. But they didn't, they just left it. He didn't turn the bull up too high.
Uh-huh. Nice and easy.
Yeah, nice and easy.
Uh-huh. You know, one thing that came to mind, I don't know if this is easy to answer or not. Do you think that there's something America today in 2024 can learn from America during World War II?
All I know, this is a crazy world, getting bad every year.
What keeps you going?
I'm pretty active. I spend most of my time outside. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't stay in the house all day long. I got to get out and do something.
What do you do?
Well, get a hoe or shovel, go cut weeds, take a walk, work on my car if there's something to do. Yeah, like the other day, got my boat out, cleaned it all up, started it, got it ready to go fishing when it cools off a little bit.
You don't like sitting still, huh?
No, I got to keep going. Like I say, I drink quite a bit, but it's just about that much whiskey, and then the rest is water. Uh-huh. I don't drink it straight. You don't see me drunk.
Glad we set the record straight on that.
Never lost a day's work in my life. And I was always busy from a little kid on up.
So don't expect that to change as he heads toward that 101st birthday next February. That is the one and only Frank Babaria. If he does decide to join Central Valley Honor Flight on its next mission, listeners in the middle of California can welcome him and 70 other veterans home on September 18th. If not, maybe you'll run into him deep sea fishing with the A to Z Foundation or out and about in Kings County. You can find some photos relating to Frank and the stories he shared today at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.